Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave, the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. Join Dave and his guests now as they share practice tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help get you through this day. Now, here's your caregiver host, Dave Nassani.
From Los Angeles and Manhattan, a big LA and a big Apple, welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I'm Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, and we've got the privilege of having Adrian from the Caregiver Space, Adrian Gruberg. Say hello, Adrian.
Hi, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and we're at caregiverdave.com and thecaregiverspace.org, and we're broadcasting on Facebook Live as well, Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver. And the Caregiver Space, and Bob Harrison, our guest.
Yes.
We do have an exciting interview planned for you today with my lovely co-host, Adrian. First of all, I'd like to wish everybody, a Happy New Year and hope you had a happy holiday. Did you have a happy holiday and a Happy New Year and a Happy Hanukkah and a Christmas? Because I know you cheat sometimes. You celebrate Christmas, Adrian.
No, it's not a matter of celebrating it. It's part of the culture in New York.
Part of the culture.
You can't avoid it.
Yes.
But yes.
Thanks to Rockefeller Center. I just saw
exactly.
a documentary on the Rockefellers last night on history. Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So our guest today, author Bob Harrison, and he wrote an amazing book. I'm going to have him explain that to us. And just I want to thank Adrian and I for last week. We were our own guest. We always like to thank last week's guests. And we were talking about the holiday blues.
Yeah.
And even though we did it a day after Christmas, Adrian assured me that the blues don't stop the day after Christmas. So that means that it's a great show, and all our shows are on all of our 15 platforms, you know, like iTunes and YouTube and Spreaker and SoundCloud, Vimeo, Stitcher Radio, Blog Talk Radio, Mixcloud, Listen Notes, Blueberry, Player FM, Podcast.com, VIP Internet Radio, and Facebook Live, as well as CaregiverDave.com. Adrian, would you introduce our guest since you know him so well? And while you're doing that, I will fix the Facebook Live thing so that it's on both of your thing, because I can't chew gum and talk at the same time.
Well, I consider Bob my best ambassador. He is the most active participant and moderator and everything, go-to guy on the caregiver space. And he's there. Pardon me. He wrote his book because of Annie, because his wife, whose name was Annie, passed from cancer. And his book is as good a telling of what that is all about as anything I've ever read. I have it right here. I'll get it down and I'll
You have it right
there.
You
have
it
right there, Bob? Yeah, there
Somebody
you go.
Has it.
Because of Annie.
Say something, Bob, so that your picture can get big on the screen, and then we can see it
so
better.
So my picture can get big?
Okay. Yeah.
There you go. Now hold the book up while you're talking.
I wrote the book for my family. It was never intended to be anything more than a family book. And then I had an idea. Well, wait a minute. I can use this book, maybe, to get in some places, open some doors for me so I can talk about Annie. And I was fortunate enough to find the caregiver space, because most of the cancer websites turned me down because they felt like it was, I don't know if I should say this or not, but it might distract from donations because it's a true story and it's real. I don't pull any punches. I talk about cancer and when you're caregiving for a loved one and what it's all about. And it is mind-bending, it is a nightmare, but it is also very beautiful, loving, and there's a lot more to this than just cancer. It's about love.
Right.
About being loved. And I think it's done exactly as I wanted it to do. I was at the Man and Woman of the Year Awards in Wichita, Kansas. 526 affluent people paid $125 a plate to hear me, the special guest speaker, talk about because of Annie. The book raised roughly $5,000 that night, and for cancer. And every penny has gone into cancer. I don't take money from the book because that would be like taking it from my wife. And she never allowed that. She had her card, so I had mine. So anyway, no, that's not the reason.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's start with asking you, how did this all start? Because you were in the service, right? And explain, because I read the story and it was just touching, heartwarming. Explain how you met this girl named Annie.
It was back in 1971.
Yeah, we were all hippies back then.
I was a hippie too, but I was in the military. I was basically on my way home about 8 months earlier, and the Air Force said, "No, we're going to extend you for another 10 months, and you're going to be shipped off to a place at RAF Wethersfield, and we're going to have the mission down there." So when I got to Wethersfield, me and the boys had a four-bedroom house, Victorian house, out in the woods with trees and the flowers and all this kind of stuff. Went to the club one night, and I was sitting there, and we'd been dancing and hanging out with the guys and the girls, and I saw this beautiful lady sitting over my right shoulder, and she was beautiful. I was mesmerized, and I kept looking over at her, but I thought, well, she's not looking at me, but she sure doesn't look happy. But fate intervened. There's no doubt. It was fate. I went to the bar to get another drink. The drink was crowded. So I walked into the outside foyer to go to the loo. And
loo.
I saw this.
Explain some of us what the loo,
the loo is.
Is.
The loo is. The loo is a bathroom. In England, it's a bathroom.
And in America, it's the head.
Yeah, the head.
That's loo, on a ship bathroom. Also.
Right. Well, I walked into the foyer and I saw her back. I saw the back of her standing there talking to my best friend, Jay. Jay was a very, very intellectual guy. He wouldn't say anything until he thought about it for a second or two. So I walked up behind her and I was standing there, and she didn't know I was there. And she said to Jay, "Will you take me home? I'm not happy." And Jay thought about it for a second. When he opened his mouth, Irene leaned over and whispered in her ear, "I'll take you home." And she turned around, looked at me, gave me the most beautiful smile that I had ever seen. And we locked hands right there. No going back to the dance floor. Went straight
out. Good thing Jay was a slow talker, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I almost got beat. But she had been looking at me, too. I just didn't know it. Later on, when she had cancer, she told me a story about me that I'd never heard before. And that was part of it. She had been watching me that night, too. So
and she waited till the very end to tell you that?
Yeah. Well, wow. I asked her to tell me a story when she was laying in her hospital bed, and mm-hmm. this is the story she told me. Because she kept some things for her, you know, people do.
We all do, yeah.
She shared it with me, and it was pretty cool. But and actually, that story's in the book. But that's how it happened. And
is there a picture of her on the back cover or somewhere you can hold up and let us see how beautiful she was? Beautiful little hippie flower child.
There's glare on it. It's
yeah, tilted a little to the left and to the right.
And talk.
How about that? Can you see it now?
Hold on. Keep talking. Yeah, there you go. A little closer. Closer.
Well,
yeah.
Let me tell you a story about that. When you call her a little hippie girl. Well, that night.
I think I'm borrowing your words, though. Go ahead.
That night, we went back to the house where I lived, went back to the house where I lived, she sat on the sofa, and I walked into the kitchen to get a couple drinks. I came out, she was gone. I thought, well, where did she go? Man, this is the quickest date I've ever had in my life, you know. And the door was ajar, which was a setup. And so I started looking all around the house for her. I couldn't find her, and so I went and sit on the couch. And the next thing I know, she's over my back. She grabs me by the back of the neck and goes, rawr, like that. And I went, she's a keeper. She has to be.
Oh. So you told her you'd take her home, but actually you never got home.
Well, I did. We never made it home. She stayed the night
it was
with
1971,
me.
You know.
Well, she stayed the night with me. The next morning I woke up. When I woke up, I reached over to, you know, just to touch her, and she was gone. I thought, well, now what? She's gone. Well, I got three roommates, you know what I mean? They're kind of wild like we all were. And I'm making a lot of noise, and they're yelling at me to quiet down, you know. I got up, walked over to the window, and I looked out this Victorian house out into the gardens. And she was down there. She had a flower in her hair, and she was picking flowers for the kitchen, for the house.
Oh.
And it was in a long, muted maxi dress with laced-up sandals to her knees. It was beautiful. It was just a beautiful thing. You know, and I saw it, and I thought, ah, that's it.
So was that guy she was with a blind date?
I didn't ask. I don't know. He's a big guy, so we didn't go back in there.
Forget him. Yeah,
he's a big guy. Big GI. Yeah.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you. Continue with your story.
And
the flowers.
From that point, yeah, the flowers. And she, I grabbed some clothes and ran down there, and I helped her pick some flowers. We came back in and found a vase and put him in the vase and set him on the table. And it just went from there, you know. It was wonderful.
Have you spoken to Hallmark? I think this would make a great Hallmark movie screenplay.
Well, I've got a friend who he owns a large monument shop in Nebraska, and he makes them like his biggest cars and stuff. He's really into that stuff. And he's the one that he contacted me when he'd watched a Hallmark movie. He said, "Wow, this should be a Hallmark movie."
Well, it's unanimous.
Said, well,
okay.
I didn't say any more than that. Anyway, from that point on, I built an online memorial for Anne in 2011 after she died. And it was to tell her story, tell my story, to talk about her. I posted over 100 pictures on there of her. And it's had over 105,000 views since it's been up.
Wow.
And people love it. And it's Earl, the monument guy, told me that he'd look 6 months for a story that would go with his business and his associates' businesses, because there's a lot of them connected, and they have like a group. And they asked me if they could use Annie as to help them promote their business.
Poster girl.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Right, and I said, absolutely. You do whatever you want. and they said, well, do you want anything? I said, I don't want anything. I just want the word to get out. That's all. I'm not interested in money. I'm interested in helping people. That's it.
Right.
And it was just kind of the way it was. So.
So how old were you both when you met?
It was 1971. I was 23.
Okay.
I
and
just
how
turned
many,
20.
How many years 24. Did you
we're
have?
We're the same age, Bob.
I know we are. I know why you forget things, the same reason I do.
And I'm the youngster here.
Yeah, you are.
Not by much, but.
We were married 39 years.
And when did she get the cancer?
She was diagnosed in, it's funny, she wasn't funny, but it kind of is. She's coming back from Catalina Island on the 19th of April, 2008. And when she got back, she had a bunch of bruising and stuff on her arms and stuff, and it was just from carrying suitcases. And because I wasn't with her, I was running the business. And we talked about it, and she seemed to feel okay. But then she started getting really, really sick, and they started doing tests. And they'd been testing her for a year and a half already for certain things, because they couldn't figure out what was bothering her. But
how
we
old
saw
was
the
she
bruises.
At this point? How old?
Well, that would have been.
Or what year?
She was 57 then. That was in 2008.
So you had decades together, your normal life.
Most of my life was with her at one time, 39 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's
great.
You know, the thing about cancer is with blood cancer, there's no pre-screening. So they really did everything, like I said, for over a year, trying to figure out why she was having difficulties, even though she, here's the thing, here's the trap. You look too good to have cancer. You can't have cancer. That's the trap. You got to stay out of that trap. And Bonnie, I was sitting in the living room one day, it's in June, and she got a call from her doctor, and he said, I'm so sorry, and we need to get you into the cancer center. And we're going, okay, well, maybe it's not cancer. Maybe it's something like that, else. Because huh? they said maybe it's not cancer, but we need you to see an oncologist. We went in to see Dr. Moore, see the oncologist, Dr. Moore Sr. And when he walked in the room that day, he's a short, stocky guy, kind of bald. He'd been an oncologist for 39 years, the first blood cancer specialist in Wichita. And he walked in the room and he said, how you feeling, Ann? She goes, well, I don't feel well, but I don't think I'm sick. And he looked at her and he goes, well, that's really strange, because he had just looked at all of her urine and blood tests.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next minute I know, he's yelling out, bone marrow. The bone marrow biopsy. These ladies were standing outside the room. They had to be. They came running in there with this stainless steel cart with all these instruments on it, to include a corkscrew type thing about a foot long. And I'm thinking, what are they going to do to her? And they laid her on her side, and I thought, well, this is going to be painful. So I got up and wrapped my arm around her neck, and I grabbed her hand with my left hand and held her hand and just held her. And it was pretty sad, really, because the only thing she said was, ouch. But when they were through, Dr. Moore Sr. looked down at her and said, Annie, I think Bob took this worse than you did. But I was crying. I was crying. It was very hard for me to see her in that kind of pain, you know, and not be able to do anything about it. I couldn't fix it, you know.
Yeah.
And he sent the biopsy off, and 2.5 days later, I got a call from his nurse, Tracy, and she said, Bob, I've got some bad news for you. Your wife's got multiple myeloma. And I said, what's that? What's your prognosis? Is she going to be okay? He said, well, if she can take therapy, no, she said, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, unless she can take therapy, and then it may be a little longer. But she's not going to do well with this. And I started, I started crying. I cried for about an hour. I cried for about an hour, and she said, you need to calm down. You've got to get Ann and bring her up here to the cancer center by 3 o'clock. And I said, well, what am I supposed to tell her? What do I tell her? She said, tell her we found some abnormal stuff in her blood, something like that. And it was a lot, and I felt really guilty about it. But how do you tell your wife she's dying? Mm-hmm. And when she got there, Dr. Moore Sr. said, you have multiple myeloma, terminal, it's metastatic, it's treatable, but it's not curable. But she didn't know about the phone call that I had.
Right.
So she didn't know that her time was up. Well, 3 weeks into her cancer, her spine collapsed, both femurs broke. Her right hip broke off.
Oh my God.
She had 4 broken ribs, and she was essentially dying. And that was how end stage myeloma normally goes. But here's the thing: she didn't die. She did not die. And when she broke her femurs, well, there's a story there that it's written, but I haven't talked a lot about it. We were standing up in her bedroom. This is a funny story, kind of a good story. We were standing up in her bedroom, in our bedroom, and she's looking in the mirror. She's trying to get her hair fixed up because her right hand is full of amyloid, which is deposits. It's kind of like a protein that the myeloma will deposit. It could be your heart, your lungs. It was in her hand, and her whole hand was like carpal tunnel syndrome. I mean, she was in so much pain with that. Well, they had done surgery on her hand all the way up to her wrist. And they removed the amyloid. And she had an appointment to go see Dr. Lucas that day at the big clinic. And when I was standing beside her, she went to turn to the right. She was checking her hair in the mirror. She went to turn to the right, and I heard a pop. It was her leg. And as she started to fall, I reached over and grabbed her. And I held her up, and she's going, what am I going to do now? And she's crying, what am I going to do now? I pulled her over to the bed and laid her on the bed. And I said, hang on, Annie, I'm going to go down and get you 3 more morphine, because by that time, the 3rd week she was on morphine, 2nd week she was on morphine for diseased bones. And I grabbed her 3 morphine, came up, gave her the morphine, and she started feeling better. And she's broken up now. We didn't know how bad, but she was broken up.
Wow.
And she said to me, I said, Ann, I'm going to call the paramedics now. And she said, no, don't do that. I said, are you kidding me? She says, no, I want to go see my doctor of my hand. I said, Ann, we can't do that. I got to get you to the hospital. I heard the break. She said, I don't care. I want to go see my doctor about my hand. Well, my nephew, Andre, he's 6'2". He's from England, a big, strong lad. He was downstairs hearing all this commotion, freaking out because he just lost his mom to cancer. I called him. He came running up the stairs. I told him what he was going to do. And he says, you're joking. I said, no, I'm not joking. She wants to go see Dr. Lucas. So in the meantime, I called Melissa, who was a nurse at the clinic. She called Dr. Lucas and briefed him on what was going on. So we got to Lucas's office. He started unwrapping her hand, and he goes, I don't want to unwrap your hand. He took her straight into the x-ray room, and they found all those broken bones. And in the process, her spine collapsed. And it was a nightmare, but Dr. Moore Sr. came in and saw her, and we got her to the hospital. He said, Bob, I heard what you guys did. You went to see Dr. Lucas? I said, yeah. That's the courageous thing I ever heard of. And he was laughing. He was laughing. Well, she was too. She laughed through everything. I mean, how much pain can you tolerate and laugh like that? She was always laughing. People loved her smile. I mean, she was such a motivational factor to the people in the cancer ward. I mean, she'd sit there and talk to people that were getting chemo. Wow. And she's dying of cancer, and she'd say, I feel so bad for them. And I'd say to her, Annie, there's no one in this room less fortunate than you are. You know, you're sick, really sick. But she wouldn't accept that, you know? So that's how she did it. But,
wow. Well, let's take a break. Hold that thought. Let's take a break, and then we will come right back, and I want to talk to you more about that. So don't go away.
Dave Nassani, the caregiver's caregiver, has just released his 6th book entitled It's My Life Too. Reclaim your caregiver sanity by learning when to say yes and when to say no. It was specifically written for caregivers who know they should be putting their needs first, but just don't know how. Dave is the sole caregiver to his wife, Charlene, since 1996. He knows firsthand what caregivers are going through, because he is one. And he now speaks all across the country, offering caregivers his incredible caregiver support package. Even the airlines tell us that in the event of an emergency, to put your oxygen mask on first before you help your child with their mask. They know that those who don't heed their advice often black out, thus becoming unable to help either themselves or their child. And caregivers are exactly the same way. It's My Life Too. Reclaim your caregiver sanity by learning when to say yes and when to say no. Will help caregivers who are neglecting their sleep, diet, and social life, and learn to put their needs first. Pick up your copy today, or buy one for your special caregiver, on sale everywhere, and at caregiverscaregiver.com.
Dave and Adrian Gruberg and our guest Bob Harrison, author, and Bob is telling us about his book he wrote about his wife Annie, because of Annie. So go ahead and continue what you were saying, Bob. I interrupted you in the front of in the middle of a story. Do you recall?
when we were in the when the hospital after Dr. Moore came in, because she was still on chemo, and she was on chemo for 6 months, but she was she's complaining about her back hurting so bad, but no one knew why. So they took her down to the X-ray lab, and they found that her whole spine, majority of her spine, had just collapsed. Totally.
What does
collapsed.
That mean when your spine collapses?
It just crumbles down. It just kind of collapses.
So the cartilage,
the vertebrae, they just crumble. They just turn it like dust.
Bone on bone. So the spine is still intact. It's right.
And it's not every single one of them, but they still call it a collapse because
just all
they
of a sudden,
drilled.
Right?
they drilled four holes on each side of her back, and they put down, they put on vertebroplasty, and that's what they used.
So but they were able to fix that. Know,
well, they can't fix it. They just secure it,
right,
and reinforce it. And when they
she was not walking, I assume now.
Right, right. She wasn't. She never really walked again. I mean, she could shuffle her feet, but
so originally they said she's going to live a few weeks, and she's doing 6 months of chemo.
Chemo.
They started her on. How much time did that buy her?
Well.
And was it worth it?
After the third week, she's living day by day. I mean, that's the one thing that they said to us. You know,
she was still doing the chemo.
Yeah, Dr. Moore Sr. told me she will not survive this cancer, Bob, but we're going to go as far as we can with her. We're going to push. We're going to work hard. You've got to be an extreme caregiver. You've got to do everything right. You've got to do it on time. You've got to be diligent in what you're doing. You cannot relax. And then I had my daughter, Melissa, who was a nurse. She was like a wingman, so we covered her really well. And
was this her decision to do the chemo?
Well, yeah, she wanted to live.
You allowed her to make so many choices. I mean, just going to the hand doctor was an example. If she had opted not to have treatment, I mean, how would you have felt about that, Bob?
I would have said,
was
okay.
Was she doing it for you or was she doing it for her?
No, she had to endure
a lot of pain.
Yeah. She didn't do for me. It was like she had her wishes and my job was to follow her wishes.
Yeah.
This is what I would like, Bob. And I'll say, okay, I'll do everything in my power to make sure this happens. Mm-hmm. My daughter, Melissa, was the same way. We followed her wishes. She was in some tight spots, comas, ventilators. I mean, she's on a ventilator for 5 days, dying.
Yeah.
And we kept it going. And guess what? She got off that ventilator smiling. Yeah. It's like she always did. And they said, Dr. Tom Moore was infectious disease control. He was nominated for the CDC just after he took care of Annie to be assistant director of the CDC. He was her disease control specialist. And he said the odds of her surviving that ventilator were incalculable. He said, you cannot even, you just can't put a, there's no way. Well, you know, she did. She just survived everything. She kept surviving everything.
I'm asking the question because so many people, you know, and I've said it myself. I says, you know, if I ever get cancer, I'm not going to do the chemo. I'm not going to do, you know, how much time could they buy you? I believe more in quality of life than quantity. And it's like my mind's already made up, and I might change my mind if it ever happens because everyone has to decide for themselves. I've met people who have done both things, know that I want to live, and no matter what, I'm going to fight this thing, I'm going to win, you know. And some of them aren't very fortunate because they suffer for months and months, you know, with the chemo. Chemo is like, you know, poison. It just makes you feel like you want to die, worse than seasickness. And after a while, you know, some of them say it wasn't worth it. I wouldn't do that again. And I know it's always different for everybody, and everyone's motives are always different. But did you guys talk about this, about should we do treatment? What kind of treatment? When should we stop treatment? When should we throw in the towel? No discussion like that at all?
There was no towel throwing in ever. We were never going to throw the towel in. That wasn't even an option. That was not an option. Yeah, that was not an option. She, when the chemo issue originally came up, he said to me, they wanted to put her on a clinical trial and study, which makes the medications mostly free. And they had a new drug out there that was really, really state of the art, but it was very, very expensive. And they said, your insurance is not going to pay for it.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm retired military and they pay for everything else. So let's see what happens. So he ran it through the system and it was paid for.
Wow.
My copay was $9. Blue Cross and Blue Shield's copay was $2,400.
I'm sure glad we take care of our vets.
and she got the chemo, and it was Dr. Moore set me down and talked to me, and he said, you know, Bob, I could save so many lives if they just had insurance like you have. I can't. He said it's unbelievable because the way the system works is the insurance company will approve the drug that might work. This is 2008 now. That might work. And if it don't work after 30 days, they'll go to something a little bit better, and it might work. And Dr. Morse Jr. explained to me, by the time we get the drug that works, it's usually too late. He said, in your case, you're getting the best drug on the market. She needs it. And let's just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it.
That's the difference
months,
when you're choosing from financial point of view or health point of view.
Yeah, well, they 5 months later, 5.5 months later, she was in remission. Now, don't get me wrong. Remission for her was not remission like everybody else. She was broken up. She was beaten down. She was sick all the time. Pneumonias, you name it, comas. She was never in a remission to where, like, her people that she knew that were diagnosed the same day as her with the same stage of cancer, stage 3, which is the highest stage, they're out driving their cars and coming to their appointments and getting their treatments. She had to be lifted into a wheelchair and taken to her appointments. And she saw that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't feel pity for herself. Never. I felt pity for her, but she
what
never
What was her motivation
herself.
To continue going through that pain with such low odds?
We never really told her the odds.
Yeah, but you knew what they were.
Yeah, but I always lived on
so
hope.
What do you think her motivation was? Do you think she just didn't have enough facts to make an educated decision?
No. Anne was a lot smarter than we gave her credit. She knew what was going on. She was in a coma, and Dr. Moore Sr. said to me, Bob, be careful what you say. They hear
she
you.
She can hear, yeah.
She can hear you, which we proved when she was dying, because she died in this house, right where I'm sitting, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole process was certainly not fun for her, and it was painful, and I'm just wondering what makes a person just trudge through this mud after day.
I guess you'd have to live the story. Anne was a smoker, right? She wanted to have a cigarette, and she can't smoke in the hospital. She had an IV hookup to her and all kinds of stuff. And I said, okay. I went to the nurse, and I said, can I take her outside down across the street? But I didn't tell him what for, because Anne didn't want anybody to know she smoked, right? And I said, I'll take you down there. So there's me, Melissa, and I think somebody else. We drug her down 8 floors in the wheelchair with her pulling that chemo pole out across the field to the smoke area. And then she wouldn't have a cigarette. So, no, I'm not going to smoke because someone might see me. So we had to take her all the way back. Until you lived a story like that. I took her in a gift shop at the hospital. She hadn't been shopping in 10 months. She spent $450 on junk. Just junk. I call it stuff.
Yeah,
and
we
got outside
shopping.
She had a blast. She was so excited. It was like a kid in a candy store. And we took her back upstairs. That's when she had her stem cell transplant. We took her back upstairs. She
sometimes Bob she was given, the left she, the left bud it fits better in the right ear or vice versa.
I think I got a weird ear here.
Try swapping them. Sometimes they just fit better because they were actually made for the left ear and the right ear, believe it or not.
Oh, it fits real well.
You see?
There you go.
That's why
after the fourth time that fell out of it, I said, I know what's going on.
Well, it gets on my nerves. But anyway, yeah, that was, it was a joy caring for her. I mean, she was funny. She was full of laughter. I mean, she laughed from her belly. People around her were so excited. We had a hospice party for her here with about 15, 18 nurses and food and cakes. And
did you know her, Adrian?
I mean, it was just real.
Did you ever
meet
him?
No, of course not.
You only met him when he became a caregiver?
Yep. Part of the, yep.
That was in October of 2014.
I think love was part of the motivation to keep going, Bob.
Oh, it was always
loving
love.
Life.
It
love.
Was always love. You know, there's, here's the thing. You've got to put this in the story, even if it's sometimes people don't like the thought, but I don't care, to tell you the truth. Annie was an atheist. Or when I say atheist, she's an agnostic. She believed in the spirit world, the Indians, the feathers, and all those kinds of things. But she didn't
spiritual.
Believe in, Yeah, yes, she didn't believe in God, but she didn't believe in a God. When she got sick, the most amazing thing happened. She went into a coma in August. That was 2 months after three months after diagnosis. One month the day after she broke her bones, she went into a coma. This would have been August, mid-August. And she, the nurse walked over to me and Melissa, who were standing in the hallway, and she said, well, we have no expectations of her surviving this either way, one way or the other. And when we were pushing her into the room, Melissa and I were standing outside around her bed. It was just Melissa and I and I think a couple nurses. And we looked down the hallway and we saw this lady. She was big. She was kind of heavy. She had one of them real old-fashioned nurses' hats on from the 50s, which scared the jeebies out of me. And Melissa and I looked at her and I said, and Melissa said, did you see that, Dad? I said, yeah, I did. We were worried about it. Well, anyway, she starts coming our way. So we quickly get that bed shoved in the room and get away from the door because we're afraid she's going to be Annie's nurse. We don't want her to be. She's too old. I mean, I know that sounds terrible, but this lady stood outside the door looking in, and there was two nurses kind of blocking her way. And all of a sudden, she did like a fullback or something. She put her arms out and she just busted through those nurses like they weren't even there. And she went straight over to Annie's bed. She put her hands on her face like this and she said, God loves you so much. You're such a beautiful lady. She kept saying it over and over and over. And then she said a prayer that like shook the ward, I think. Everybody was like, what's going on here? Because
like
that
was
not
an angel.
Something she was Annie's angel. And after she got through praying all that stuff, she walked over to Melissa and I, and she said, you must be the family. I said, I'm Bob, her husband, and this is my daughter, Melissa. And she says, well, is she a Christian? I said, no, doesn't believe in God. And she said, well, then we got work to do. and she came back the next day, and I was able to ask her. I said, Beverly, how did you know it was Anne that you were looking for? Because she had told us that night she had premonition on the way to work that she was going to meet someone very special and very beautiful that night. And she said, I just met her. And that was a premonition. I said, how did you know it was Annie? She said, well, there was a gold ring around the bed when it was sitting down the hallway. I was standing there. There was no gold ring. She said, there was a gold ring. There was a gold ring. She said, it wasn't for you, Bob. I saw it. So I knew who I was going to go see. And that's how it happened.
Like an aura? A gold aura?
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. She called it a gold ring, but it'd be an aura probably, yeah. And Beverly is one of the most spiritual person that you could probably ever meet. She's really kind, gentle, nice. She's now, I think she's 75 now. And she's...
She's a real person. Because sometimes you hear about these things where somebody shows up out of nowhere, and then they just disappear, and say, well, who was that masked man?
Well, she was a 30-year oncology nurse, and she was a 50-year nurse. 30 years was in, the last 30 years were in oncology. So we had her on our side from that point on.
And she never had a new uniform.
It was really, she'd come over to the house, she'd sit and say, Annie, you mind if we read the Bible? And Annie'd say, would you like to read a Bible? She'd go, Annie, would you like to read a Bible? And Annie'd go, yes, please. And they'd start reading the Bible.
What is your faith, Bob? Were you an agnostic
Christian
as well?
No, I've always been a Christian all my life. But I when I met Anne, I stopped going to church. That was back in 1971 because she didn't believe in putting money in that plate and making the rich people richer. And if it's going to cause arguments, you tend to stay away from it. At least I did. But that was all. No, I prayed. I used to pray every night for God to show her the way to salvation, but I didn't mean for it to happen that way. Mm. That really, really, really hurt. That hurt me really hard because I thought, man, this is what I've been asking for, but not that way. And I don't believe that's why it happened that way, but I don't know. It happened. It's a true story. I mean, it happened. Beverly was there from that day on. She went with me to bone marrow. She'd hold Annie and be praying while Annie was getting her bone marrow done. And I mean, she wasn't there every day. It was not like that, but she was there for Anne. So yeah, it was pretty important.
Well, listen, we're going to take another break, and when we get back,
yeah,
I want to check. I want to talk about the book when we get back, okay? So
okay.
Don't go away. We'll be right back.
One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships is about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resemble that of both a Martha Stewart and a Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on the right side. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Just hear what best-selling author Lynn Barrington has to say about it. If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story told from the heart. It's inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light. One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships. Available everywhere.
And
watch
we're
if you want.
Back with Adrian Gruberg and Bob Harrison, author. So, Bob, tell us about the book. Why'd you write it? When did you write it? And what do you hope to accomplish with it?
To be honest with you, I wrote a previous book. It was called God's Plan for Annie, Why She Had to Die. But I self-published it, but I wasn't happy with it. It was just a really, really, really strong reflection of grief. And because I was grieving so much, the people that I was working with, the self-publishers, they cleaned me out. They took advantage of me every way they could, and I fell for everything they said.
Oh, that's horrible.
And so I ended up canceling the book. I canceled it. I said, no, I'm not doing this. You've got my mentor, he's a retired Air Force colonel. He said, Bob, they are really, really taking you for a fool. I said, well, I think I am a fool because they took me for a lot. So I took that book. I thought, this is perfect. This was just my notes. I'll use those notes to write the book that I want to write. And I wish I would have made it a caregiving book because it really is all about caregiving and what it takes to be a caregiver.
You could always change the title and the cover, you know.
I want to do one for me. I want to do one that's what I want to do next.
All right, then.
I've got like 15 blogs on loneliness that are 4,000 and 5,000 words. I think I can put a book together pretty easy.
that
Adrian and them published, so yeah. But I wrote the book in 2014, but like I say, I put it together. It was based on another book. And I will tell you, Barnes & Noble, both times I did a book signing, both books were the bestseller that I ever had in their book-selling event. And I sold
both
a lot
books,
of books.
Huh?
Both books. The first one did the most.
Really?
It had a lot of people bought it. But I couldn't tolerate being messed around like that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just I'm not that guy, you know. And I don't mess with people. And I don't want to be messed with. But I canceled it, turned it into the other book because of Annie, and it did really well too that way. But I never promoted it. I never bought into any of their let's advertise it here, there, and everywhere. I didn't do anything for that book except join Caregiver Space. And even Adrian will tell you on the Caregiver Space, I don't talk about that book. I don't put it on there. We put it on there the first day I was there, maybe 2 days. But I don't, it's not, I didn't, I use it for me. It's for me. It's a tool. I work with that book. It helps people.
And on Bob's author page, it's called Because of Annie.
Right.
So that people make that connection and do know.
Well, she's got a cancer page, and it's because it's got the picture of me sitting on a bench, loneliness. But it says on there, if you love someone today, try to love them more tomorrow. That's her cancer page, and that's a grief page. It's all about grief. I work on that too. About every 4 nights, I put a new post on there, and it's
great.
An international thing. So I do that, and of course my Facebook page. I've done my Facebook page, my 800 friends have been just incredible. They have supported me from day one, ever since I started writing on there after Ann died. I didn't have any friends when I started writing Ann, when she died on Facebook. It just grew and grew and grew. The following just got bigger and bigger because I was telling a real story.
It wasn't
like I'm making this stuff up. You know, it's real. And anyway, I wrote the book for me, so I could use it to help others, not to put it out there and try to make a lot of money off of it. Yes, it made money at 3 or 4 different events that I spoke at, did well. But other than that, people will write to me on the Caregiver Space, say, where can I get the book? And I had 100 copies, and I would say, I'll send you a copy and just make a donation to cancer, to blood cancer. And a lot of them would send me like a $100 check. A lot of $100 checks, and I'd give them to blood cancer. That's a lot for a book, $100.
Yeah.
Well, they give more. They'll donate more than they'll pay for a book, put it that way.
When did you meet Adrian?
October 2014. I didn't actually meet her. I met the young lady that was on before Corey. I forgot her name.
Allie.
Allie. I started with Allie. Allie was very excited and all this stuff. But right after I met her and did the first blog, she left. And Corey came along. And I get along with Corey like house on fire. So
yeah.
It's really worked out. So from there, Corey took care of all my blogs. At first, she would edit them. And then she said, I'm not going to edit your blog.
No.
You do just fine. And then you'd edit your blogs. So she just stepped back. And I was putting out 4 months for about 13 months. And they were long. They're not short. These aren't little blogs.
No, like, and your comments are thoughtful and personal.
Yeah.
And that goes such a long way. Because I know when I make a comment, it's not just a rote comment. It's to the person. Who has written a question or a comment. And you really take the time to answer in depth, and it's beautiful.
Well, and a lot of it for me is it comes off the cuff. I mean, it's really fast. My response is really fast because it's an internal thing for me. It's inside of me. I know what people need. I know what they're feeling. I understand.
Wisdom.
But with Corey, it was. I don't know. I called her my Fruit Loop for a while there. You know, she's just funny, and we hit it off really well. And she's the one that suggested that I probably should turn my grief and loneliness blogs into a book because they're so powerful. She called me up February the 1st or 2nd of 2016, and I know the date. She said, Bob, your blog has blown up. And I said, what do you mean blown up? Because you've had like 200,000 hits on it already, and it's only the first day or something like that.
Right.
It got to 500,000 hits. Yeah, and it had 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 shares. And
these are just on the Caregiver Space?
Yeah, yeah. And then I had a lot of them that got 200, 300,000 clicks that I know are good blogs.
Yeah.
If I wanted to make a book,
how does that happen, Adrian, if you only have 165,000 people?
Well, you have 165,000 people who are members.
Uh-huh.
But you can access certain pages without being a member, and that still registers.
Wow.
But once they start to share it,
the sharing,
that's when it goes.
It goes because
And
they told two friends, and they told two friends, and they told two friends. It just keeps mushrooming.
That's how it works. When I post on my Facebook page, I'll post a story about Annie, and I'll end up with, say, 75, 50 people that aren't even – I don't even know who they are. They're friends of friends. They picked up off of a friend's Facebook page and came in to my page and liked my – because I'm open to the public. And they liked my page, you know, they liked the article. And that's how I meet a lot of people that way. I've got friends in Estonia. I got friends in Venezuela. I got friends in Tasmania. I got friends in London. I got friends in Scotland, Ireland, Rome, Madrid, Venezuela.
Isn't that Puerto Rico.
They all
That's
speak
from
English,
blogging.
Huh?
That's from blogging. Well, they do, actually. Most of them do. And a lot of I've got a lot of Filipino friends, quite a few.
A lot of Filipino friends, yeah.
They're good
great
people.
Caregivers.
They're great friends. And all over the world, and that's all from the caregiver space. So I've done what I set out to do. I mean, I'm not there yet because I'm trying to, like I said, I'm trying to save the world one person at a time, but
yeah.
You know, that may not happen, but if I can help someone every day, then I'm happy. And I do that on caregiver space 7 days a week. I'm there 7 nights a week, every week. And that's what I do, work with people.
Wow.
And that's
you
what
see,
the book's done for me.
You see why
it's,
I love
it's because
Bob
of
so
Annie.
Much.
So how
it's
many?
Because of Annie.
How many do what he does on your page? I know he's the best, but
how many people?
How many just ambassadors?
Me.
You call him an ambassador.
Just Bob, and Corey when she can, and me when I can, and I'm going to be doing it more and more. Probably later. Later today, I'll get on with my New Year's greeting. I'm going to start doing a Facebook Live thing as much as I can.
Yeah. I've been waiting for that.
I know. I'm listening to you.
I've been watching.
I
seen
know.
It.
No, it should start today.
So you're starting Facebook Live.
Oh,
You've done them before, haven't you?
I've done some Facebook Live things. But they've always been at serious times when I needed to, you know, like when I said, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, the Affordable Care Act is, they're taking a vote and you've got to make your voice heard. So there've always been messages to try and get people to do something. Mm-hmm. But now, it's just going to be me.
So, yeah, well, that'll help. We need
Adrian
that.
Gruberg, unfiltered.
We need the leader. We need the leader. We need her out there telling the people her vision. Listen, I wanted to say something. Yeah. I want to talk to, I know we only got a couple of minutes, but dying at home, that was Anne's choice. She wanted, one of her core wishes was, I want to die at home. I want to be cremated as quickly as possible. I want my ashes taken to England as fast as you can get them there and sprinkle them with my mother and my sister. And those were core wishes. And she died. The story of the mortuary people coming here and the policemen, the firemen, when they die at home, a couple come over. The policemen, all the people that were here, doctors and stuff, it was a house full. And it was, even though it was a death, it was still beautiful. But I think my lasting memory is her being placed in the back of the hearse and taken away. I was with my daughter, Melissa. And dying at home is a controlled experience if you know what you're doing. I guess I was blessed, but man, she died over 26 hours. And she woke up in the morning and she was spitting up. Her mucus was full of blood. So I already knew she was bleeding from low platelets. She was bleeding internally. I already knew that.
Yeah.
And the sign that her lungs were filling with blood was an emergency. And Anne looked at Melissa and said, let's get started. That's how it happened. That's when we all got up from the table and took her into the bed and started giving her morphine.
Did you have any hospice at home?
No, they tried, but I fired them twice.
Okay.
I mean, not because they were bad. Because
well,
I fired
you had
them because
Melissa.
Well, no, if you're bleeding internally and they're 20 miles away, what can they do? What can they do? They can't help me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I asked her that question. And she said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'll put my arms around her and love her through it. That's all I can do. What else can I do?
Yeah.
You know, I can't make it stop. So, but the morphine automatically, the liquid morphine, slows down the process. It slows down the bleeding. Melissa did the morphine for 36 hours till she died. I did it one dose. I gave her one dose. Melissa gave it to her for 36 hours along with liquid Xanax. Not much, liquid Xanax every hour. It had to be that way. And then when she got the death rattle, it was atropine. Atropine kills the death rattle in seconds.
Mm.
It's really quick. We carried that in the military in England for 19 years. I carried atropine on my body, an injector in case we got hit with nerve agents. We could inject ourselves. So, yeah, it's a... But dying at home, is if you can do it, is an incredible experience for everybody, because that's where people want to die, a lot of people. They want to die at home. Yeah. Caregivers are afraid of that, but it can be done.
Well, thank you, Bob. I can't believe the time has already gone, and we have to say our goodbyes. It's like the, like the Three Musketeers. Now it's time to say goodbye to all our friends. Emily.
That was Mickey Mouse, dude. I remember that from the 50s. From the
50s. Indeed.
Matt Funicello with the big ears. Live.
Yeah. So how do we get a hold of you, Bob, if somebody wants to buy your book or talk to you or just hear your wisdom?
It's on Amazon.com. I don't people get a hold of me through caregiverspace.org.
Okay.
Bob@thecaregiverspace.org.
That's your own
That's
email
all
over there.
Bob at the caregivers. Yeah, I think I share it with Corey. She knows a little bit much more than she needs to, but
yeah.
My email. No, she told me that. Like I said to her, I said sometimes I'm busy. I get 15 emails. What am I going to do with them? She says, I'll read them for you. That's cool. I don't care.
She's amazing.
Yeah, I don't mind. She's great.
Hey, Adrian, how do we get a hold of you, Adrian?
It's Adrian, ADRIENNE. At thecaregiverspace.org.
Awesome.
And I just want to thank Bob for everything that he does for us. I want to know how much he's appreciated.
He sounds amazing.
He is.
And somehow he hooked up with me. How long have you been hooked up with me, Bob, following my...
quite a while. Probably a year and a half. You and Charlene, I've been following you. I mean, you know, I admire people that do what you do. I mean, it's amazing. I've seen you in New York and everywhere else on TED. I mean, sometimes I'm working the caregiver space and I can't stay and keep watching you because I've got things going on I have to do, you know, because
caregivers
come first.
Well, I appreciate you. I'll make you president of my fan club if I ever get one day. Thank you.
Well, you probably got one.
No,
you guys have a nice evening, and God
Thank
bless you.
Thank you. You too.
Thank
God bless you,
Bob.
All.
Thanks for everything.
Appreciate you coming on the show, and I'll talk to you all later. Till we see next time. Bye bye.
If you ever want to talk grief, let me know.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program with Dave Nassani.